This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
And of course, having a climate denier in charge and climate deniers, you know, running the Senate is unbelievable in this era, right? We're facing the biggest challenge humanity's ever faced. The world is starting to truly mobilize. The business community's getting nervous. The financial community's getting nervous for the first time, you know, really. And we're talking as if it may not be a problem. It's insane.
In optometry, 2020 means normal visual acuity. But what will 2020 mean for the rest of us in the coming year? What sustainability trends might take flight as we close out the second decade of the new millennium? This week on Sea Change Radio, we take a glimpse into the future with author, speaker, and corporate sustainability consultant, Andrew Winston. We discuss the need for decreased consumerism in the fashion industry, the coming boom in water technology, and how the specter of the November election looms over it all. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Andrew Winston. He's a corporate sustainability advisor, speaker, and author. Andrew, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
It's good to be back. It's been a while.
It has. A lot has changed, of course. Now that we're in 2020, we can stop looking back at 2019. 2020 seems like it's gone on for quite some time already, though. I want to dive into the political realm because it's kind of hangs over everything. But just from a pure climate policy standpoint, what should people who care about the environment be looking for in 2020 as some kind of trends?
Well, you know, my work is mainly with companies. And so that's the lens, you know, I'm generally using kind of in my professional life. And I think there's increasingly pressure on companies to use their political influence. And that's a lot of what I've been writing about lately. And they have to use their political levers. They have incredible power, especially in the U.S. They have lobbyists. And, you know, there's one sector that shows up for these kinds of debates. If there's a policy in the works on a price on carbon or something in energy, the fossil fuel companies show up and fight it. And the other sectors, basically everybody else, kind of sits it out. And, you know, I think the pressure's rising. There's a bunch of NGOs pushing on companies about this. There's employees pushing on companies about this now, which I think is maybe even more powerful. And they're going to be asked a lot of questions about what do they stand for, you know, especially in a year where we're clearly going into an incredibly contentious, very important election. And, you know, we can talk about this not as a business thing, just as a pure, you know, kind of political leader question. Aside from whatever else you think about Trump, he's a climate denier. And, you know, if you care about doing something about climate change, having that in power is really dangerous for us.
You have an article in Harvard Business Review recapping some of 2019, but looking at some of the trends to look for in 2020. One that caught my eye was Vogue magazine announced it will use its brand and reach to reduce the footprint of apparel by educating consumers about reuse and sustainable fashion. I'm curious if you think this is a move in the right direction in terms of reducing consumption, especially in the fashion industry, which is a pretty stunning trend over the last decade or so, how much more we're buying in terms of clothes.
Yeah, so the data on apparel has kind of gotten more specific in recent years. I think McKinsey's done a bunch of studies on this, and you've seen other things. And some of the studies say apparel and footwear, maybe as much as 8% of global emissions. I mean, that's you know, three times planes. It's, you know, it's more than cement or whatever. It's a big number. And the water footprint of apparel is actually really incredibly big. And it's true that, you know, over time, fast fashion has been a real driver of this, and people, you know, constantly changing their wardrobes at a pace that, you know, we never would have years and years ago. I think there's two aspects of this Vogue story. It just caught my eye in 2019, you know, late in the year, was that a magazine that basically sells people on buying more stuff, which is, you know, most magazines, most marketing, is saying, well, let's have a larger conversation about consumption in general. I think that's been really rare. It's something I've kind of been looking for in companies, to have this really tough conversation about, you know, can we use less of this thing or whatever it is that we're, you know, selling? And can that be a better conversation to be having, or a better relationship to have with a customer, to say, let's work together on this. But I also found it interesting just to use a media property to talk about a kind of larger message for the world, or try to tackle some big sustainability problem. You don't really see that too much either. And I think there's kind of, sort of, there's in a way two aspects of it that are really nice starting points for hopefully more companies to do something. And just in the last week, The Guardian decided they would no longer take advertisements from fossil fuel companies. So I think you're starting to see some media companies think differently about their role. And you know, you and I were talking right before we started recording that we both came from media background. I used to work at Time Magazine years ago. So I always have a kind of soft spot for media, and actually have high expectations for them. And I don't think they've been leaders on sustainability at all. And so it's good to see some players start to ask some different questions.
I think the trend has kind of come around full circle. As I just within my own peer group, I've noticed that people are a little bit more proud of wearing things that they got from used clothing stores and online and Craigslist or whatever, and be like, yeah, see this great shirt? I only paid $8 for it.
No, there is some simplicity movement.
Exactly.
Out there.
So that I'm wondering, though, if Vogue and the other high fashion magazines might start falling in line with that and start kind of touting things that are secondhand and still look beautiful.
Yeah, it's possible. I think I read an interesting article, in Fortune magazine last year about, you know, Marie Kondo, who has the books about...
Does it bring you joy?
Does it bring you joy? But the article was interesting because it said that they were actually pointing to her as an actual, like, noticeable force on flattening the growth of fast fashion. You know, it's interesting. Some people have criticized her on the environmental front for, like, when everybody's throwing stuff out, are they recycling? What are they doing with it? But I think the much larger impact is if the idea of being, you know, more simple, cleaner, with the, you know, fewer things in your life means you buy less stuff. And apparently it was affecting fashion because people were going, yeah, I don't need as many items in my closet. I want to buy things that last and, you know, have a longer life to them. And that's more sustainable. And, you know, so I want things that are more basics and can be fashionable for longer. And I think there's likely to be some support for that, I would think, in like the fashion or apparel industry. You know, I don't know the industry that well, but I think you're going to see more and more of, like, you know, really nice basics. And how do you have something that lasts a long time? And that fundamentally makes it more sustainable, right? And that's a good trend. I think it's the right way to go.
I'm reading a history of the East India Company, which was the largest corporation in the world of its time. And it was such a dominant force in not only global trade, but world politics. This is how the British took over India, was through the East India Trading Company. When we were talking about water usage in fashion, India was kind of the birthplace of the modern fashion industry. A lot of the words that we have, like Madras and things like this, are fashion words, are based on places in India and Indian fashion innovations. India is on the verge of some severe water shortages, though. Let's pivot to that vital country and see how that's going to shape how we look back next year at 2020. What role do you think India will play?
Well, look, I think they're representative of what's going on, that water is going to become an issue in so many places in the world. We saw it, you know, about a year and a half ago in Cape Town, South Africa, where they almost hit day zero, meaning they would have to shut down the taps, like literally turn off the water. And they got within days of it, but they, you know, put in place a lot of restrictions. And I think they're still heavily in place. So it's a city that isn't going to be able to use a lot of water, maybe ever. Some of these, you know, some of the aspects of climate change is that some places just will have less water. They'll become more deserts. And that might mean that they don't really support the population that's living there. And so there were articles, you know, all during last year about, you know, 20, 25 cities in India, you know, really approaching day zero. And, you know, I don't know what the immediate solution for this is. I mean, there's countries like Israel that are coastal and have put a lot into desalination to deal with their general drought. They're in desert fundamentally. But what do you do in the middle of a country? You're not near the coast. You can't desalinate. I mean, we're going to see a need globally for much better technologies. And so I think there's so much focus on clean energy and clean cars for good reason. But I think there's other aspects of, you know, what's the clean economy, what's the efficient economy, that's things like water efficiency and also, you know, building efficiency in general. And all of that, I think, is just going to have a boom over the next decade. And the water will be super pressing. You know, it's like it's a nice to have to make your building more efficient. It's a must have for a city to be more efficient about water and find ways to use less, not waste as much, repair pipes so you're not losing. I mean, there's crazy numbers even in the U.S. about what percentage of water is just lost, you know, because there's leaks all throughout the system. And, you know, it's obviously really inefficient to do that. So I think we're going to see a boom in a need for water tech. And that, you know, I don't know if that happens immediately this year, but we're certainly on the way to, you know, understanding what are the big thing, you know, technological holes that we need to fill, and you know, where's their potential business.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Andrew Winston. He's a speaker, author, and corporate sustainability advisor. So, Andrew, we were talking about water usage, and the fashion industry is one of the areas where we can kind of look at supply chain management from a corporate sustainability advisor like yourself. This is key. Mm-hmm. What kind of innovations in the data and tracking realm have great potential for the years ahead?
Well, look, I mean, just from a strategic or kind of macro view, there's obviously more and more data being collected on everything, right? I mean, the big tech companies know everything we do and track every click.
And that's kind of the scary part of data. But from a sustainability standpoint, there's some great potential.
Yeah. The more data you can get on the footprint of your suppliers, the better you know how efficient their business is and where the big footprint issues are. And I think you've been seeing experiments for the last few years using new tools like blockchain. And I think blockchain was super hyped, you know, a few years ago, and it probably got ahead of itself. But there was a fun story last year, you know, about SAP, the big tech and data company, that was helping bumblebee tuna track fish from ocean to table. So you could know exactly what you had in front of you and where it came from. And there's been some really interesting experiments over the last couple of years. I mean, Walmart, took one particular product. I think it was watermelons, but I'm blanking. It might not be. And they tracked it back, and they were able to track something that would have taken a couple weeks to get the data and do it in minutes. Once they had kind of put the entire supply chain for that product from one kind of region into blockchain. So you don't know how fast this is going to come along, but there's always that idea with new technologies that it might have been Bill Gates who said this. You overestimate what's going to happen in the short run and underestimate the long run. So blockchain was everything a couple of years ago, and it's like it's going to revolutionize, and it didn't immediately, but it doesn't mean that we're not going to hit some tipping points where there's just so much data flowing throughout the value chain that you can do some things immediately that you couldn't before.
So let's turn to the 900-pound gorilla in the room, which is the election coming up in the U.S. in November. That's kind of what I think we're going to look back at in 5-10 years and say, this is where America and the planet kind of righted itself a little bit, or this is where we really just doubled down on all things terrible.
Yeah. All I know is we have to get out there. And if you put aside whatever else you might find disturbing about this administration, and just look through this lens of sustainability or environmentalism, whatever you want to call it, the dismantling of the EPA is incredibly disturbing. there's been great data that shows the air quality's gotten worse in our country, and that actually kills people. So there's like measurable, huge effects, both in cost to the economy and in people's lives. And of course, having a climate denier in charge and climate deniers, you know, running the Senate is unbelievable in this era, right? We're facing the biggest challenge humanity's ever faced. The world is starting to truly mobilize. The business community's getting nervous. The financial community's getting nervous for the first time, you know, really. And we're talking as if it may not be a problem. It's insane. And we're kind of giving up on the growth engine of the next 20 years, which is building the clean economy. We're proudly, you know, establishing that we're now, I think, the biggest, I think we're about to be the biggest natural gas supplier in the world, and we're one of the biggest oil suppliers. And to me, that's kind of like being the, you know, the best typewriter company, right, before PCs and, you know, iPads came out. So I just don't understand, from a country perspective, an economic perspective, why we want to keep going down a path of old technology. So look, I think we need to change who's in power, obviously, to have any kind of sustainability agenda really take off. And I think it's going to be very hard if we don't also see a change in the Senate.
So, Andrew, you mentioned how America being a big producer of natural gas in this era is akin to being a typewriter manufacturer as we enter the computer age. I think that's a pretty powerful image. Maybe you can kind of tie that in to the corporate world and divestment. You cited BlackRock CEO Larry Fink's letter in a Harvard Business Review. Why don't you summarize the importance of that?
Yeah, so Larry Fink is the CEO of BlackRock. They're the largest asset manager in the world, meaning they have the most money to manage for pensions, for investors, et cetera. Over $7 trillion. I mean, it's an incredible amount of money. And he's been writing letters, you know, for years and years, every year about, you know, his view of the market or whatever. He'll send one to his investors, and he sends one to the, you know, CEOs of the world's largest companies, because he's a large shareholder pretty much of all of them. And starting 4 or 5 years ago, he started to talk about really sustainability and ESG, environmental, social, and governance issues. And he would say, you know, companies got to think long term. And then, you know, a couple of years ago, he started talking about purpose. Companies need to have a purpose. And that was all great. But, you know, the company didn't really back it up with too much pressure on companies. He just wrote this letter. But this year, you know, a few weeks ago, he came up with a much more detailed and much more kind of specific thing, which was to say climate change is a really big deal, and it's going to cause immense, you know, financial damage. And he made the case that we're going to see huge shifts in capital, huge amounts of shifts in where the money goes in the world. And I think that's a powerful statement. And if he's right and others follow, that means the money's all going to go to the clean economy, and it's going to move away from the fossil fuels. And frankly, all the organizations, schools, cities, whatever, that have been fighting divestment, I mean, divestment just, you know, is good financial sense now. And there's a bunch of banks and investors in the last year that have been starting to pull out, first from coal, and then eventually they'll pull out from the others, because it's a bad investment, because, you know, the market's growing in the other tools, the other technologies.
How much do you think the market is being moved by the exploding climate protest movement? How much are the BlackRocks of the world being influenced by the Greta Thunbergs of the world?
It's always hard to say. And I think he mentions that in his letter. He says, you know, protests around the world. He kind of throws it out there and says it's an issue. I think it affects things. It's social. Look, social movements change the norms. You know, their companies and governments, you know, got behind, you know, equal rights to marriage. But on some sense, the norms had already changed, you know, that the perspective from just average people moved.
Yeah, that was just a legality issue in a lot of ways at that point.
Yeah. I mean, and so you see the norms switch first. And I think that happens through voice and protests and people on the ground. But, you know, it's an interesting thing that I've talked about on a bunch of podcasts and interviews is that, in my experience, and when I've talked to executives about their journey or why they care about sustainability, and I did a little research on this a few years back and talked to a bunch of CEOs, you know, they cared about the business case, which is what I've done for 15 to 20 years. But it was kind of just, it was part of the argument they needed to have there just to kind of justify. They're like, okay, the business case, we can make money doing this. But it was really, for almost everyone, it was very personal. And it was personal, you know, experience with something. Maybe they went to the rainforest and really saw what was going on. Or quite often it was basically their kids. So it's not just youth, like in theory, out in the street. It's actually people's own kids. And I see that story over and over again. I just saw an article with the CEO of Air France, and she was saying that her husband and kids were pushing her on climate. And so she's like, yeah, we got to get to biofuels more and figure out ways to use less fuel. And, you know, so I think there's this moral movement that has, you know, gotten into people's homes. And that affects what we're comfortable doing, you know, as a society, as a business, as individuals. And I think it's working. So, yeah, I think it affects the money because you're hearing what I hear from banks also and investors is that their private wealth clients, big, rich families, and in particular, the younger people in those families are asking about this and want, you know, what they call impact investing. They want to know their money's doing something good. So it is coming from younger voices, but in every way.
You misread my meaning when I met you. Close the door and left me blinded by the light. Don't let the sun go down. Although I search myself, there's always someone else I see. I just allow a fragment of your life to wander free. I'm losing everything. It's like the sun going down.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to author, speaker, and corporate sustainability advisor Andrew Winston. So you call it using political influence for climate good. What does it mean for the companies that you advise or would advise?
Well, what I mean, you know, in the most simple terms is that you go and lobby for policies that move us towards the clean economy away from carbon. And there's a kind of list of obvious categories of policies that means, something like a price on carbon. You know, get behind that. Get behind, you know, incentives for new technologies, incentives to farmers to do regenerative agriculture, mobilizing private and public kind of money, you know, getting R&D going in the right direction, performance standards, like you could get behind, you know, the fuel efficiency standards of cars, of buildings, of heating and cooling. You know, there's lots of policies that are, you know, out in the world. And my point is that companies have incredible political influence, especially in the U.S., especially since Citizens United, the Supreme Court case. They can throw so much money. And in reality, they don't use that influence for this topic. You know, they might go in on trade issues, or they're a big beverage company and there's a bottle bill, or there's something about metals, or, you know, they'll go in and lobby and try to avoid regulation. That's been kind of the purpose of most lobbying for most of history. And they don't go in and really, to their reps, go into the senators, go into the capitals of the world, go to Washington, go to Brussels, go to state capitals, and go see those reps and say, this is what we want. And until they do, I think it's going to be very hard to get the kind of, you know, large-scale policy movement that we need to have systemic change. Companies cannot do it alone. We as individuals cannot do it alone. You know, us, you know, using the right bag or not using straws is really not going to do it. We need systemic change. And companies have so much power, they need to use that power.
We always think of corporations kind of using levers of power for unjust change, from an Aaron Brockovich type thing where it comes to polluting, where the company was helping officials look the other way. How can we get companies to help people look the right way, I guess, is kind of what we need to do to change our way of thinking.
Well, look, I've never been one to think that companies are inherently evil or inherently good, or, you know, the world's not black and white. Companies are not black and white. And yes, there are companies that have done some really horrible things. And some of those, you know, have gone out of business or should have gone out of business. And there's been, you know, actual fraud, right? Like VW wasn't just, you know, kidding around with cars that they claimed were clean or burning. It was fraud, right? So there's companies have done many things that are not great. But at the same time, there's companies doing a lot of good in the world, and they're producing products that we need, not just, you know, everyday stuff, but they're also producing all the stuff that's better for the environment, right? There's a big industry now in the clean economy. So I think we need business. We need them to convert to seeing that building a thriving world is the most important mission, and that is their path to success and profit. That there is no future for the world without tackling climate, tackling water issues, inequality, and there's no future for business without that. So it's, you know, it's a really kind of large scale argument that, you know, doing good has always been categorized as, you know, some kind of anti-profit, you know, hippie, you know, help the polar bears thing, and it's just not, it's never been, I think, characterized right. And so there's, you know, those of us in this field for years saying this is good for business because it's just, you know, being good for society is good for business. And kind of making that connection clearer is really the work that I and you know, others like me do, is getting companies to see that it's in their best interest.
And we see companies having to adjust to the realities of climate change, from AT&T with their storm damaged equipment, yep, water shortages for companies like Coca-Cola, or here in California where I am, PG&E having to declare bankruptcy because that's of right, wildfire risk and its issues with its own equipment. These are big, big companies that are, they can't just put their head in the sand about climate change, although maybe policymakers are.
Right. Well, that's my point is, yeah, businesses are seeing the costs now. It's not, what's changed in the last few years, I mean, business has really come around, is that it really isn't theoretical anymore. You know, we used, I guess 5 years ago, you could argue it was about climate models and whether the scientists were right. But just look at what's been going on in Australia. I mean, just the scale of the damage going on now from, you know, storms, from floods, from droughts, from fires. It's just bigger than it's ever been, and it's going to continue getting bigger. And so companies are seeing the cost, and there's, you know, a lot of banks and companies putting numbers on this stuff, like insurance companies, and putting numbers on the risk. And that, you know, going back to the Larry Fink letter from BlackRock, that's part of what he was saying. There's real risk to the economy. There's you know, an impact on companies directly and on sectors. And if companies aren't managing that risk, then they're not being well run. I mean, that's part of what he said in his letter. You know, they're not being well run, and we don't want to support companies like that. So I think we've hit this tipping point on climate and business. We have a long, long way to go, and there's still so much inertia in the way we operate companies, you know, profit first, shareholders first. But we're finally seeing the biggest companies say, hey, maybe this hasn't, you know, been ideal, this mode that we've been in for so many years. Maybe it's time to rethink it.
Well, I always appreciate your insights. People can find more about your work and writings at andrewwinston.com. Corporate sustainability advisor, speaker, author, Andrew Winston. Andrew, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the Grey Boy All-Stars, the Melodians, and Elton John. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.